May it please the court, counsel, Alan Epstein representing the Mariner defendants. With me at counsel table is Tom Quinn. I'd like to address three issues this afternoon, if I could. The first, whether the judgment on the CCPA claim must be reversed because plaintiff did not establish the public impact and causation elements of that claim. Assuming that he had, whether the Healthcare Availability Act damage caps apply to that claim, and third, whether the trial court erred in failing to apply collectively to the negligence and outrageous conduct claims collectively the $250,000 cap. The CCPA cannot be used to remedy a purely private wrong. The plaintiff must demonstrate significant public impact. Public impact is determined by the number of customers directly affected by the challenge practice, the relative sophistication and bargaining power of the consumers affected by the practice, and evidence that the challenge practice has previously impacted other consumers or has significant potential to do so in the future. And the Colorado appellate courts and federal district courts have required the plaintiff to prove this element and have not hesitated to reverse a judgment or dismiss a claim where the element has not been proven. In Brodger versus American Home, the Supreme Court held that the public nature of a defendant's profession or industry was insufficient in and of itself to establish the public impact element. In the Four Corners nephrology case cited in defendant's opening brief, the federal district court held that to establish the significant public impact element of the claim directed at a healthcare defendant for false advertising, the plaintiff must not only demonstrate that the defendant falsely advertised its services, but that patients relied on the advertising in choosing the facility for treatment. And in Crow versus Tull, the Supreme Court did not hold that one customer was sufficient to establish this element. In fact, it acknowledged the advertising of the defendant attorney and that the TV advertising was widely disseminated, but remanded to the trial court to determine whether that advertising had a significant public impact.
Don't we have a number of surveys and other items of evidence that indicate that other residents of the nursing home were misled by the advertising as well? Certainly they complained about conditions, didn't they?
The survey evidence is relevant to the misrepresentation element of the CCPA claim. It was not relevant to the public impact element because that related to the representations made by defendants. The public wasn't reading the survey information and deciding, oh, I'm going to go to Mariner because these surveys are persuading me to. The surveys were not relevant to the public impact element because the plaintiff's theory of public impact was that the brochures lured people there. The survey information was irrelevant to that claim. That element, I mean. And plaintiff introduced no evidence that plaintiff introduced evidence that Mariner published and distributed brochures, but did not introduce evidence that this advertising induced any resident to go there. No present or past resident was called to testify that they were lured there by advertising.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I didn't mean to. Do you want to finish that thought? Or?
No relative of a resident.
And my question was picking up on that. In terms of showing public impact, do they have to show that others were induced by the advertising, or just that the inducement seems to be relevant to causation? I realize you argue that as to this plaintiff, but in terms of public impact, wouldn't the widespread nature of brochure dissemination and advertising help establish that without showing that anybody, in fact, relied on that to get to Mariner?
No, I believe that the case law, particularly that Four Corners case, in my reading of it, is that and Crow versus Tull, is that you cannot infer from the fact that there is advertising in and of itself that there was a public impact. There has to be proof that the advertising caused other residents to other customers to be persuaded to go to Mariner. The fact that there is advertising out there doesn't make the claim, doesn't make the element.
So even if there's, let's go further and say false advertisement out there or misleading advertising out there, that this patient, although I realize at one point he said that didn't make the decision for him, his person who was counseling him and him went through that, decided on this facility based in part on the literature, that that is not enough to have a public impact on widely disseminated literature?
The, well, the test, his test, plaintiff's testimony was that he was shown a pamphlet by his social worker. Well, first he testified Mariner's advertising didn't cause me to go there. Then in redirect examination, he said, I was shown a pamphlet by my social worker, but he didn't say I read what the contents of the pamphlet were or that it influenced his decision-making. I don't think that's sufficient, no. That's inference on inference. The social worker didn't testify that she placed him there for that reason. And again, the plaintiff must also establish that the challenge practice caused his injury. Plaintiff did not testify that the marketing materials lured him there. He testified that he went to live there to be closer to his family. And we would ask that the judgment on the CCPA verdict be reversed, as well as the attorney fee award that was entered pursuant to that claim. Assuming that the elements of the CCPA claim had been established, the HCAA damage caps apply to that verdict. 1364.302.1b states that the total amount recoverable for all damages for a course of care in any civil action for damages in tort brought against a healthcare institution shall not exceed $1 million, not more than $250,000, of which may be non-economic damages. Plaintiff was awarded $4,800 in economic damages. If the remainder of his damages were non-economic tort damages, then the plain language of the HCAA caps these damages at $250,000, and they were tort damages. And the trial court ruled that the caps do not apply because the CCPA is not a statutory tort.
Let me ask you this in terms of the breakdown you just gave. We only know that breakdown because of the verdict on a different claim. Is that right? I mean, in a normal CCPA claim, you don't ask for that kind of breakdown.
Breakdown.
I thought you said that there are $4,800 in economic damages.
Yes.
That from the negligence claim, don't you?
Right.
And in a normal CCPA claim, you don't require or would not have that breakdown. If they'd only brought a CCPA claim, would we have that kind of breakdown?
True, but the damages in this case were in two categories. Notwithstanding, the CCPA damages are characterized as actual damages. In this case, the damages were economic damages and non-economic damages.
And on a different account.
Yes.
On a different cause of action.
Yes, but all of the damages that were awarded under all three claims, besides the $4,800, were non-economic damages. They were non-economic personal injury tort damages. The jury divided them up for whatever reason, but they were all non-economic tort damages. And the distinction...
Did anyone object in the trial court that there was no evidence of damage under the CCPA?
I believe that, yes, there was a directed verdict. I can't remember exactly what the basis of it was. I believe that was part of the motion for directed verdict on the CCPA claim. But
let me ask you a question. Let's assume that while the plaintiff was in the Red Rocks nursing home, he was waterboarded. Tortured, some would say. Is that covered by the $250,000 cap? And if not, why not? And if so, why?
Well, if that's a part, that's an extreme example, but it would be involved in his course of care, although I would argue that would be outside of his course of care.
Outside of his course of care for what reason? Because there's no medical justification for doing that? Or because it's an intentional tort?
Well, the act does not distinguish between intentional torts. The language of the ACA does not distinguish between intentional torts.
So you think it covers intentional torts?
The act covers intentional tort damages.
The Health Care Availability Act covers intentional torts.
The language of the statute is any civil action for damages and tort.
Do you know of any institution, healthcare facility, hospital, nursing home, practitioner of the health arts that has within their course of care the commission of intentional torts?
Is that covered under the?
Well, I mean, is it within the purview of the professional health care that's being provided to commit an intentional tort?
No.
The jury here found this was an intentional tort. The CCPA claim was an intentional tort.
Well, they found that there were misrepresentations.
It also found that it was intentional, outrageous, whatever the terms were under the statute. It also found that.
That's true.
And that gives rise to third treble damages.
That's true.
Okay. So my question is, does a course of care exclusion or limitation on damage cover intentional torts?
The language of the statute would include.
Now the purpose of that statute is to reduce premiums so that health care can be provided at a reasonable price. Can you insure against intentional torts?
You can't insure against intentional torts, but addressing the insurance issue, if a complaint contains a negligence claim and a CCPA claim, the carrier is obligated to defend all claims.
Not required necessarily to indemnify.
Right. Well, the healthcare provider would have to indemnify, but the provision of a defense for the entire all of the claims contained in the complaint increases the litigation, which in turn increases the cost of insurance. I'd also point out that the particular portion of the CCPA at issue 611051G provides that a deceptive trade practice is representing that goods, food, services, or property are of a particular standard, quality, or grade if the defendant knows or should know that they are of another. And insurance policies are construed in favor of coverage. The or should know language would take it outside of the intentional act exclusion. Finally, just briefly, the trial court on the negligence and outrageous conduct verdicts, the trial court properly determined that these claims arose from plaintiff's course of care while he resided at Mariner. And to go back to the question you were asking, the trial court found that all of the alleged conduct occurred within the one course of care, and that determination was not cross-appealed by plaintiff. The court ruled that it wasn't one course of care, and that ruling is inconsistent with its ruling that the HCAA damage cap applies separately to each verdict. The plain language of the act applies to a suit, not discrete causes of action brought in that suit. And the defendant requests that the court reverse the CCPA verdict and the attorney fee award and apply the $250,000 cap collectively to the negligence and outrageous conduct verdicts. And I'll reserve the few seconds I have remaining.
You want them both to be under one cap, right?
Right.
The negligence and the
outrageous conduct.
Outrageous conduct.
Because that's what the statute says.
That's not the CCPA claim, or it is?
Well, all three of them. But at a minimum, we're saying that if you're taking the HCAA or the CCPA claim out, it clearly applies to the two common law tort claims.
It's my impression that's what the court did.
No, the court entered a judgment for $250,000 on the negligence verdict and $250,000 on the outrageous conduct verdict. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jerome Reinen, number 22031. I represent the appellee, John Gordy. I want to focus a little bit on what Judge Roy was asking Mr. Epstein about a moment ago, and that is the intentional conduct. Is the intentional conduct of a healthcare provider immunized simply because that person may be a healthcare provider or associated with being with healthcare? And the answer is no, clearly not. The jury in this case found something fairly extraordinary as cases go, and they found that this healthcare institution not only acted intentionally, but acted in bad faith, and they lied. And that is a finding that has not been raised on appeal or disturbed on appeal. They admit that that is the finding of the trial court and the jury after hearing the evidence in this case, that this healthcare institution lied to its consumers, including to Mr. Gordy.
Mr. Reinen, assuming that to be true, what language in the HCAA exempts intentional torts?
Well, I think to answer that, Judge Casebolt, I want to make certain that there's a distinction between what is a tort and what isn't. Now, the CCPA, violation of the CCPA is not a tort. The CCPA is not a tort. It's a statutory remedy, statutory cause of action that did not exist in the common law. The Crow v. Tull Court discussed this quite a bit at length, and they said that there are different elements in proving a CCPA claim than there are in proving malpractice or a tort. The CCPA is not part of the common law, has different elements, and it redresses public wrongs, not private wrongs. And that's an important point, because in a tort, you have a person who is injured by the acts or omissions of another based on that person's breach of a duty of care. A CCPA claim has none of those elements. There is no duty of care for CCPA. The question is, did you deceive someone, or did you deceive the public, or didn't you? The other distinguishing...
What's a common law fraud claim? Is that a tort?
Yes, it is.
And it is, you know, how's the difference between a fraud claim, one common law, one statutory, but is not this basically a statutory claim of deception?
Well, the difference between the common law fraud and CCPA deception is that it affects the public. A fraud would be a private wrong between two parties. One party defrauds another single party, or maybe a limited number of parties that are involved in the same transaction. The CCPA was created using, in part, some of the tort law, but also using contract law, according to this Heller v. Silver Branch construction case. But the main distinguishing feature is that the CCPA is a public deception, not a private wrong. And this is advertising. This is a health care. In fact, when Mariner was operating, they were the largest nursing home chain in the state. And they're sending out advertising over the internet and through brochures to people who are vulnerable and disabled and lying about the services that they are to provide. That is a public wrong. The HCAA was designed, as Judge Roy was asking about, the HCAA was designed to control malpractice insurance premiums by making tort non-economic loss damages for a single person injured by malpractice capped within a certain range. And so the insurance providers could write insurance saying, well, we know now in Colorado that if someone gets hurt as a result of malpractice, their pain and suffering damages are not going to exceed $250,000 or now $300,000. And on that basis, we can underwrite policies at a cheaper rate and control costs. That
before you, Mr. Reinen, before you go further on that issue, though, let's get back to my question.
Okay.
What language in the HCAA says intentional torts are not covered by it?
Well, I think that the answer is that the CCPA is not a tort. The HCAA only applies to damages in tort.
Okay, well, let's assume that's true. Let's talk about the outrageous conduct claim.
The outrageous conduct claim is a different course of care. I think that in order to answer that question, I need to read to you what the 1364.3021B says in that part. It says the total amount recoverable for all damages for a course of care for all defendants in a civil action for damages in tort are limited.
And you now, have a trial court determination that this is all one course of care, and that's not appealed.
Well, the court determined that there was one course of care for the negligence claims, which were the claims for the broken teeth, the burns, and the bed sores, all which occurred at different times caused by different people. We disagree with the trial court, but we didn't appeal that for other reasons. We just we didn't cross appeal that, and we're not asking you to consider that now. But the difference between that the negligence and the outrage claim is that the outrage claim is intentional, and it is not part of Mr. Gordy's course of care. Mr.
Gordy, let me ask you this: if a physician commits a battery because he fails to get an informed consent from the patient, battery is an intentional tort. And yet that's covered by the HCAA, is it not?
It is, but that's part of the course of care because that's intertwined with whatever surgical procedure that the patient is complaining about. Here it's completely different because Mr. Gordy's outrage claim was premised upon the fact that he is a disabled man, unable to take care of himself, and on many, many, many occasions he was left unattended, soiled in his waist for hours on end, was able to smell his wastes, and complained about it and was retaliated against for complaining. Also, his call light was not being answered, and he was being retaliated for that sort of thing. And that's the distinction.
Well, clearly it's outrageous conduct. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the issue. The issue is whether it's somehow limited by the statute. And you've got to, it seems to me, shoehorn yourself into the getting out of that limitation somewhere.
Well, the way I present that, Your Honor, is to look at that Batson v. Louisiana case, the Louisiana case from 1999, which the Supreme Court of that state looked at a similar course of care capping statute and said it would be outrageous for us to interpret the statute as saying that a healthcare provider causes an initial injury and then is thereafter immunized for all the additional separate injuries they might cause that patient. If we took it to a different extreme in this case, let's say Mr. Gordy on day one was admitted to Red Rocks and someone took him and threw him out of his wheelchair and he broke his face and they put him back in his wheelchair, would they be forever immunized for the rest of his stay for causing him burns or making him sit in his wastes or any other activities that they might choose to engage in? And I think that in the facts of this particular case, the question is what constitutes a course of care for Mr. Gordy? It's relatively easy to say what constitutes a course of care for somebody who's admitted to a hospital for an appendectomy or somebody who might go to a doctor's office to have his tonsils examined. But in a nursing home context, I think that the court needs to look at, and the trial court is given discretion based on the way the statute is written, to determine what is part of the course of care and what isn't. The trial court in this case specifically determined that the course of care for negligence was one course of care, but the outrageous conduct was not part of that course of care. And that's why there are two separate awards, one for the negligence-related claims and one for the outrage-related claims.
If that's correct, why is the instruction to the jury saying that Mr. Gordy was suing for the same damages under three different claims for relief?
Well, so that they don't duplicate the damages for the different claims of relief. And that's what that's
but it's an acknowledgement, is it not, that the damages flow from this, they're the same damages?
No, I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that the instruction allows the jury to determine which damages fit with which claims and award those damages accordingly, but not duplicate them. The damages for Mr. Gordy sitting in his waist day after day and not having his call light answered are different damages than he suffered for the burns and the bed sores and being dropped on his face. And the jury acknowledged that by coming up with different numbers. And the other thing that the jury did was they assigned Mr. Gordy 10% fault for the negligence tort claims, but did not assign any fault for him for the outrage that he suffered, the outrageous conduct that he suffered. And I think this comes full circle to the concept that the CCPA claim is not a tort. It is not, it's simply not a tort. It's a creation of statute. And the May DNF case, which I think is very important here, says that the court shall not interpret the CCPA as limiting the punitive and compensatory damages aspect of the statute. The statute, the CCPA, is designed to punish and deter exactly the kind of behavior that occurred to Mr. Gordy and others similarly situated here. There was some discussion about, well, Mr. Gordy was the only person hurt. That's simply not the case. The evidence is rife with other instances of people who suffered the same sort of staffing injuries, the same sort of injuries based on the other breaches of promises that were contained in these brochures. The brochures themselves make some very specific concrete promises. They promise a lower staffing nurse to patient ratio than the other competitors. And that simply was not true. The jury found it to be that way. And the reason that we know that number of people were impacted by that is by looking at the state surveys. The state surveyors, the health department, found that all of the residents in this building at one time or another were affected by low staffing in this building. Another promise that was made repeatedly in these materials was that this was a place, this was a nursing home company that prided itself in rectifying problems through quality assurance, fixing the problems they had with state regulations. This facility had the same deficiencies entered against it time after time after time, and the director of nursing of that facility, Gene Wilson, got up and testified that this facility was not fixing the problems that were cited by the state. Again, people are being hurt in this facility.
Excuse me, is there any evidence in the record that anybody else relied on the advertising in terms of going to the facility?
Well, Your Honor, there is no evidence in the record of reliance, but I wanted to point out, and I'm glad you asked this question, because the Rhino Linings case talks about this issue of reliance. Reliance is not an element of the CCPA. It's not in the jury instruction. And the Rhino Linings case said that a widely disseminated deceptive practice is a violation of the CCPA if it has the tendency to deceive, even if it doesn't. And the case that I think is most important to look at is the Hall v. Walter case. If the court recalls the facts of Hall v. Walter, you had two adjacent landowners, one of whom had his parcel for sale and the other one had the adjoining parcel. The person that had the parcel for sale advertised that people could cross over the plaintiff's property to get to the one for sale. And the Hall v. Walter court found that even though the person who had the adjacent parcel did not read or rely on any of the advertisements or even consider them, he was still damaged by the deceptive trade practices of his neighbor. And the reason that that is important is because the CCPA is not a fraud claim. You don't need to prove reliance under the CCPA. That is not an element.
You need to prove causation. Your client needed to prove causation.
Well, actually, Your Honor, with all due respect, he did prove causation. He proved that as a reason.
I didn't say he didn't. I just said you needed to prove.
I'm sorry. Yes. The causation is that if the promises had been true, if they'd had the staffing ratios they promised, if they'd had an atmosphere of culture change where they had the menus options that they promised, if they'd had the activities that they promised, if they'd had quality assurance that they promised, if they had promised to keep their facility within regulatory guidelines as they promised, we wouldn't be here talking about this. The causation is that Mr. Gordy suffered through all of these things because the facility misrepresented actively and in bad faith what it was, who it was, and how it operated.
Let me ask you this as time's running down on just more ministerial. In their brief, they argue that the interest was wrongly imposed on the non-capped awards. Do you concede that A, it was, and B, that it's error, that at the very least it has to go back for recalculation of interest?
You're talking about the negligence of the three claims, the negligence claim. Your Honor, I don't believe that that was improperly done by the court. I understand the Goodwin case. I respectfully believe that the law in Colorado is or should be that the amount is capped above the statute, but I understand that the case law is there, and we did not respond to that.
So I took it by the non-response that you conceded it, but I didn't hear
right.
you say that. Okay.
I thank you very much for your questions, and I would ask this court to respectfully affirm the trial court and find that, in fact, the HCAA does not cap or limit the CCPA damages. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.